The Eight Immortals Travel East, Chapter 51.
You know, usually when we think about a conflict escalating, there's a predictable, very human ladder it climbs.
Right, like a natural progression.
Exactly. Like you get into an argument with your neighbor about a property line, voices get raised, maybe someone threatens to call the city, or at absolute worst, things get physical.
Yeah, there's a limit.
Right. There's a natural scale to our retaliation.
Yeah.
But what happens when you remove human limitations from the equation?
That is where things get genuinely terrifying.
Seriously. Our mission today for you, the listener, is to explore this crazy ancient mythological text, Chapter 51 of Journey to the East.
Yeah, it's a wild one.
We're looking at what happens when immensely powerful mythical beings get into a dispute, suffer a humiliating defeat, and just decide that the only logical retaliation is to literally weaponize geography.
We are looking at a scenario that completely challenges our basic understanding of, well, warfare, retaliation, and even physics.
Oh, absolutely.
Because this isn't just about two armies clashing with swords and shields. We are looking at a fundamental, permanent alteration of the Earth itself.
Yeah, just absolute destruction.
Right, and it's all driven by this terrifying through line, which is just the sheer disproportionate scale of divine hubris. We're exploring what happens when spite and humiliation mix with unchecked power.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we get to the epic destruction, we really have to understand the deeply uncomfortable emotional and tactical dilemma our protagonists are facing.
We're talking about the Eight Immortals here.
Right. And for anyone even casually familiar with the lore, you know these are iconic, highly revered figures. They're usually depicted as enlightened, incredibly powerful, totally above it all.
Very dignified. Usually.
Usually. But right now, at the start of our source text, they are not looking heroic. They've just fled to the coastline, and they are nursing a very serious, very bitter grudge.
Yeah, the text paints a picture that is almost darkly comic in its contrast to their usual dignity.
Because they just got crushed, right?
Completely. They have just suffered a crushing, embarrassing defeat at the hand of their enemies, the Dragon Kings of the Four Seas. The narrative describes how they were essentially submerged, drowned out, and forced into a really frantic retreat.
Wow.
So picture these divine beings who are used to being worshipped, standing on a beach, absolutely soaked, coughing up seawater, just exhausted and furious.
Which makes you wonder, I mean, if they can't beat them in the water, what are their options? Do they just wait out a divine stalemate?
They're certainly not the type to just let it go.
Right. Or is there a way to force the dragons onto dry land? Because it feels like they're staring down a massive tactical roadblock. The Dragon King's forces aren't just strong. They are currently at the absolute peak of their power.
Exactly. They control the oceans. They have the home field advantage, the numbers. They have everything.
So what do they do?
Well, what's fascinating here is the psychology driving their next move. We tend to view immortal figures as stoic, you know, maybe above the petty squabbles of mortals.
Oh, totally.
But this myth grounds them with incredibly relatable, highly human flaws. This isn't just a strategic military retreat where generals are dispassionately moving pieces on a board.
This is personal.
It's all about deeply bruised egos. The text explicitly points out their intense frustration and their burning desire to, quote, snow away the shame of being drowned.
Snow away the shame. That's so poetic, but so petty.
Yeah. The embarrassment is so acute that it drives them to consider tactics they normally wouldn't even dream of.
It honestly reminds me of losing spectacularly to a massively overpowered boss in a video game.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
You know, you run in confident and the boss just wipes the floor with you using some massive area of effect water attack. You respawn, you're fuming, but you know that just running back in there with your same basic sword attacks is just going to get you crushed again.
Because you can't beat him in a fair fight.
Exactly. Doesn't this mean they have to fundamentally change the rules of engagement? It's less like trying to punch a wave and more like realizing you can just, I don't know, pour concrete into the pool.
That is exactly the shift in thinking they needed.
Which brings us to one of the immortals, Dongbin. While the others are pacing the beach, Dongbin steps up with what I can only describe as the ultimate do or die plan.
He really does.
And he explicitly says, like, if we are going to do this, we don't stop halfway.
He recognizes that a paradigm shift is required. A conventional assault into the ocean is out of the question because it plays right into the Dragon King's strengths.
So what's his pitch?
Dongbin lays out a strictly elemental strategy. He points out a fundamental law of their universe. The enemy used water to defeat them. Therefore, they must use the element that naturally restrains water. they need to use earth.
Okay, wait, I need to understand the physics of this myth, though.
Sure.
Because if I drop a giant boulder into a pond, the water just splashes out and floods the banks. It doesn't disappear. How does dropping earth actually erase an ocean?
It's not just basic physics.
Is it just a massive splash, or is the magic of the earth element literally, like, consuming the water?
It's a crucial distinction, and it ties directly into classical Chinese philosophy, specifically the Wuxing, or five elements theory.
Oh, right. Okay.
In this framework, the elements wood, fire, earth, metal, and water aren't just static building blocks of matter.
Mm.
They are active processes that generate and overcome one another.
So they have like a dominant relationship.
Exactly. The relationship between earth and water isn't just physical displacement. Earth naturally conquers, dams, and absorbs water.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So when Dong Bin suggests using earth, he's invoking a metaphysical law of transmutation. The earth doesn't just push the water aside. Its elemental nature actively nullifies and smothers the water's essence.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Because when you say they need to use earth to smother the water, you'd think maybe they're going to build a magical dam or maybe summon an earthquake.
You would think that.
But no. The weapon of choice Dong Bin proposes is Mount Tai. They're going to physically push over a mountain and use it to fill the Eastern Ocean.
And not just any mountain.
Right. Why Mount Tai? There are countless mountains they could have picked.
While Mount Tai isn't just a large rock, it holds immense cultural and spiritual weight. It is historically considered the preeminent of the five great mountains of China, associated with sunrise, birth, and renewal.
It's incredibly sacred.
Yes. Emperors perform sacrifices there to signal their mandate from heaven. By choosing Mount Tai, Dong Bin is taking one of the most sacred foundational pillars of the earth and turning it into a blunt instrument of revenge.
That's just wild.
It's an unthinkable sacrilege-turned weapon, and Dong Bin pairs this monumental weapon with perfect timing.
Right, because the dragons are occupied.
He reveals that right at that very moment, the four sea dragon kings are entirely distracted, holding a massive celebratory victory banquet in the Eastern Ocean.
So their guard is completely down. They think the war is over. The immortals are humiliated, and they're just throwing a party.
Having a great time.
And Dong Bin is essentially proposing dropping the holiest mountain in existence on their heads while they are passing around the wine.
From a military standpoint, it combines the elemental logic of earth conquering water with one of the oldest strategic doctrines in existence.
Striking when the enemy is celebrating.
Exactly. Striking an enemy during their most vulnerable moment. When an enemy throws a victory banquet, their armor is off, their weapons are set aside, and their minds are completely removed from the concept of danger.
Yeah, they feel completely safe.
So Dong Bin is proposing a preemptive strike on an unimaginable scale. Yeah. It's not a battle plan. It's an annihilation plan.
And what's wild to me is that the other immortals hear this. They hear a plan to uproot a sacred mountain, drop it on an ocean, and completely rewrite the geography of the planet, and the reaction isn't, you know, horror.
No, not at all.
They don't pause and say, Dong Bin, that's insane. Think of the collateral damage to the mortal realm. The text says they congratulate him. They cheer.
They absolutely love it.
They explicitly say, quote, this plan is excellent. They are completely on board with terraforming the planet just to win a fight.
And that transition from theoretical strategy to terrifyingly practical execution is where the tone of the myth shifts into high gear.
It gets so dark.
The text moves to the methodical execution of the attack. And the word methodical is vital here. This isn't a chaotic, heat-of-the-moment action. It is incredibly calculated.
Right, because you'd think they would just fly over, pick up the mountain, and toss it in one dramatic heave.
But they don't.
No, they prep the site first. The text notes that before they even touch Mount Tai itself, the immortals first carry and dump residual earth, sand, and gravel from the surrounding area directly into the Eastern Ocean.
By dropping the sand and gravel first, they are actively disrupting the water, causing confusion, and laying the literal groundwork for the massive displacement that is about to occur.
Wait, but is it really tactical? I mean, dumping a few tons of gravel before dropping a mountain feels incredibly petty.
It does seem a bit redundant physically.
Right. If you're about to drop Mount Tai, the gravel isn't going to make a mathematical difference to the ocean's volume. It almost feels less like a military tactic, and more like they're intentionally drawing out the psychological terror. Like laying down suppressing fire or chumming the waters before dropping the ultimate bomb.
That is a brilliant way to look at it. The gravel serves almost no structural purpose when a mountain is about to follow. It operates as a psychological weapon.
Just to mess with them.
Yeah, it's a harbinger. It alerts the dragons that something is wrong, giving them just enough time to feel dread, but not enough time to formulate a defense. It speaks to a deep underlying sadism in their need for revenge.
They really wanted them to know it was coming.
Exactly. Following that grim preparation, the eight of them position themselves around Mount Tai. They take up spots on all eight sides, coordinating their divine strength. They move as one single unit to lift this immense mass of rock and spirit.
And the text describes the sensory experience as an earth-shattering, heaven-shaking boom. You really have to pause and imagine the sheer acoustic violence of a mountain being ripped entirely from its bedrock.
It'd be deafening.
And then, with a single coordinated effort, they just dump the entire mountain straight into the sea. And the result is instantaneous. The text says the vast deep ocean is transformed into flatland. It becomes a mulberry field.
Yes, and the term mulberry field is deeply significant here. It invokes the famous Chinese idiom, Kanghai Sangtian, which translates to the blue seas change into mulberry fields.
What does that mean exactly?
The idiom normally represents the profound, unimaginable changes that occur in the world over vast, unfathomable stretches of time, like millions of years of geological shifting.
Oh, okay.
But the immortals took a process that is supposed to represent the slow, majestic march of eons and forced it to happen in a fraction of a second through sheer violent willpower.
So the ocean is just gone, replaced by dirt and rock and the immortals. How do they react to erasing an entire ocean and its ecosystem in an instant?
They're thrilled.
Yeah. They clap their hands. They laugh out loud. They declare that the shame of being drowned has finally been avenged. And then the part that truly leaves me speechless, they casually depart to attend the Longbow Assembly.
Just brushing off their hands.
Right. I have to ask, what even is that? Because the way it reads, it's like they just finished a routine errand and are heading out for drinks.
Well, the Longbow Assembly is essentially a serene, high-level spiritual gathering of divine figures in Buddhist and Taoist traditions. It is a place of enlightenment, dharma, and peaceful communion.
Are you kidding?
No, so the contrast is jarring to the point of being grotesque. Mm. They just committed an act of total environmental and civilizational erasure, effectively committing a localized genocide of the aquatic realm. And their immediate next step is to head off to a peaceful spiritual retreat.
That emotional disconnect is just terrifying.
It highlights a grim reality about power dynamics in these myths. When power is absolute, empathy often becomes entirely non-existent. They do not spare a single thought for the life in that ocean, the civilization of the dragons, or the permanence of what they have just done.
They just don't care.
Right. Their egos are satisfied, the slate is wiped clean in their minds, and they simply walk away to a social gathering.
And while they're walking away, the text violently yanks our perspective down to the ocean floor, directly into the perspective of the victims.
It's a hard pivot.
Yeah. The dramatic irony here is gut-wrenching. We, the listener, know exactly what the immortals just did, but the Dragon Kings have absolutely no idea. As Dongbin predicted, they're in the middle of their grand drinking banquet.
They are completely consumed by their own victory, surrounded by their courts, their music, and their wine. They're at the absolute height of their triumph.
Celebrating like they've already won the war.
Exactly. The cultural importance of a victory banquet in this context cannot be overstated. It is a formal declaration that the threat has passed and peace, or at least dominance, has been secured.
But the timing is just incredibly tragic. Suddenly, the ceiling basically starts falling in. Sand and rocks begin raining down around them into the ocean depths.
From the chumming.
Right. It's that residual dirt the immortals dump first. It starts clouding the water, ruining the banquet. And it's the South Sea Dragon King who is the first to put the pieces together.
He figures that out.
He sees the rocks falling and realizes this isn't a natural phenomenon. He says out loud, "This must be the eight immortals. They've escaped and they've come back to attack." So they drop their drinks. The four kings rush out of the palace to look up to see what's happening.
The sand falling acts narratively like sand slipping through an hourglass. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's a cinematic, slow-motion realization of their impending doom.
And they look up just in time to see the horrifying, impossible sight of Mount Tai collapsing directly toward them through the water.
Just unbelievable terror.
Imagine the pure, unfiltered terror of that moment. You step outside your palace to confront an enemy, and the sky itself is falling, replaced by the crushing weight of a sacred mountain.
There's nothing you can do.
It makes you wonder, though. I mean, I want to ask you, were the Dragon Kings victims of their own arrogance here? Did throwing a massive party and assuming their victory was permanent directly invite this level of destruction?
Oh, absolutely. If we look at the mythological tropes at play, hubris invariably precedes destruction. The Dragon Kings believed that because they won the first battle, the war was over.
They totally underestimated them.
They underestimated the sheer willpower, the bruised vanity, and the capacity for spite that their enemies possessed. But recognizing their hubris doesn't lessen the horror of the consequence. They're given just enough time to realize they're going to die, but not nearly enough time to do anything to stop it.
Which brings us to the physical toll of this attack, because the horrifying realization immediately gives way to catastrophic fallout. The dragons see the mountain falling, and panic sets in. They frantically attempt to scramble their army to flee.
They try to sound the alarms.
But there is simply no time. You can't outrun a collapsing mountain.
The text is brutal in its efficiency here.
Yeah.
It states plainly that the mountain falls, and the massive army led by Eorun, the West Sea Dragon King, is completely annihilated.
Completely.
The original text uses phrases indicating that the entire army perished without exception. This was a magnificent, victorious force just moments prior, and in a fraction of a second, they are wiped from existence.
Because of the earth magic.
Yes. The earth element didn't just crush them, as we discussed with the Wuching theory. It absorbed and smothered their very environment.
Wow. So out of that entire massive underwater civilization, only the four Dragon Kings themselves and a tiny handful of personal guards, the text says just a few dozen riders managed to escape the crushing weight of the earth.
They barely make it out.
They barely break the surface with their lives. And then we get to this incredibly powerful, devastating image. The East Sea Dragon King, panting, terrified, turns his horse around to look back at his domain.
And what he sees is the absolute erasure of his world. His grand, majestic underwater palace is entirely buried beneath mud and sand. The vast, deep ocean that defined his existence, his kingdom, his elemental home, it's gone.
Just flat land.
He's nothing but flat earth stretching out to the horizon.
The text describes his reactions so vividly. He is completely overcome with shock and an unfathomable grief. He beats his chest, he lets out a massive, agonizing scream, and then he vomits fresh blood and completely collapses, tumbling right off his horse.
His aides have to frantically scramble to rescue him and pull him up.
Right. And ultimately, the four ruined kings have no choice but to retreat to the South Sea to desperately figure out their next move. When I read the part about him vomiting blood, it struck me that this isn't just a sign of physical injury.
No, not at all.
He wasn't crushed by the mountain.
In classical Chinese literature and traditional medicine, vomiting blood is frequently used as a physical manifestation of extreme emotional trauma.
Oh, like a broken heart kind of thing.
Precisely. It is the result of a severe disruption of qi, or vital energy. When a character experiences grief, rage, or despair that is too intense for the mind to process, the energy reverses course, literally rupturing the body from the inside.
That is so intense.
The East Sea Dragon King isn't bleeding from a sword wound. His heart and spirit are breaking. We really need to emphasize the staggering scale of this loss. As a listener, it's easy to just hear they dropped a mountain and think of it as a cool fantasy visual.
Yeah, like an action movie.
But for the dragons, they didn't just lose soldiers in a skirmish. They lost their entire environment. They lost their capital city, their history, their literal ecosystem.
They are refugees now. They are kings without a kingdom, fleeing to the South Sea with literally nothing but the clothes on their backs and a few dozen terrified guards.
The contrast between the immortals' casual departure to a spiritual retreat and the dragons' absolute blood-vomiting ruin is the core emotional anchor of this narrative. It forces us to confront the true, unrestrained cost of divine warfare when the combatants wield the power of creation and destruction.
It really does.